Hello, I'm Bohdan Nahailo, and I welcome you to a new edition of our Ukraine Calling program for Hromadske Radio here in Kyiv. As always, there's news, an in-depth interview on a topical theme with a special guest and new music. This week, Oksana Smerechuk talks to well-known American political analyst, journalist, and veteran Ukraine watcher, Adrian Karatnitsky, who is also a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council in Washington, and no stranger to our program, about topical issues on the eve of the Ukrainian presidential elections. But first, a roundup of news from and about Ukraine. And the Euromaidan commemorations were center stage this week. On the 20th of February, Ukraine commemorated one of the most tragic dates of its contemporary history. 5 years ago, dozens of people were killed in the bloodiest episode in Ukraine's Euromaidan revolution. Most of the people who died were picked off by snipers of the now disbanded Berkut riot police. Since then, despite the fact that over 120 people were killed during the Revolution of Dignity, as the Euromaidan events became called, none of the guilty have been identified, and this remains a source of considerable dismay. Peacekeepers for Ukraine. Well, Ukraine has again urged UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres to draw up options for a peacekeeping mission to the war-torn Donbas region, despite opposition from Russia. President Petro Poroshenko told the General Assembly this week that deploying a UN-mandated peace force could be a, quote, decisive factor, unquote, in bringing an end to the five-year war. Ukraine has pushed the idea of sending blue helmets to the IS since 2015, but Russia has rejected the idea. And the issue of NATO and EU membership was also important this week. President Poroshenko signed a constitutional amendment committing Ukraine to join NATO and the European Union, though he acknowledged that the nation still has a long way to go to meet the membership criteria. And the historic speech made by the President of the Council of Europe, Donald Tusk, in Ukraine, made the headlines. President of the Council of Europe, Donald Tusk, who is an ethnic Pole, speaking in Ukrainian, declared to the Ukrainian Parliament, "There is no Europe without Ukraine." He pledged that the EU would never acknowledge Russia's 2014 annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula and would keep its sanctions against Moscow in place. Threats to the election were also much in discussion. Ukraine's State Security Service, SBU, accused Russia of meddling in the electoral process in Ukraine by creating illegal structures to help guarantee victory for certain candidates. SBU deputy head Viktor Kononenko told a news briefing that a group of Russian citizens and their Russian collaborators had used financial bribes to set up a network of people ready to vote for certain candidates and to influence public opinion. Meanwhile, Serhii Demidyuk, the head of Ukraine's cyber police, said in an interview with the Associated Press that Russian hackers are redoubling their efforts in the run-up to the presidential elections in Ukraine by stepping up attacks on the Central Election Commission and its employees, trying to penetrate electronic systems in order to manipulate information about the election. And all this is on the very eve of the elections, which are due to take place at the end of March. And the fight for Suprun reached some sort of conclusion this week. The Kyiv District Administrative Court reversed the temporary suspension on acting Health Minister Ulyana Suprun. She is again able to continue fulfilling her ministerial duties. The decision was taken on the court's own initiative and not due to the appeal from the government. Suprun was banned from performing her ministerial duties on the 5th of February due to a lawsuit against her filed by Radical Party MP Ihor Moisichuk, who claimed that the acting health minister was incompetent and unable to fulfill the role. And who killed Handzyuk? Well, Vladislav Manger, the head of Kherson's regional council, has been named as a key suspect in the assassination of the late activist Katerina Handzyuk, according to Ukrainian prosecutors. Yuri Lutsenko, the general procurator, said Handzyuk was specifically targeted by Mangyar because of her outspoken criticism on illegal logging in the region. Mangyar himself rejects these charges, calling them politically motivated, and denies meeting Handzyuk. And there have been more measles victims. Kyiv has seen its first death from measles in the current major outbreak, the health ministry announced. A 57-year-old woman died in hospital of complications from the highly infectious illness. 8 people, including 2 children, have died of measles in Ukraine already this year. There were 16 deaths nationwide in 2018. Around 20,000 people in Ukraine have contracted the highly contagious viral disease since the start of the year.
With me today, I have a longtime observer of the Ukrainian political landscape, commentator Adrian Karatnitsky, who is a senior non-resident fellow with the Atlantic Council. Hello and welcome to the studio, Adrian.
A pleasure to be here.
So when you read articles about Ukraine in the Western media, it seems to me to be 3 favorite topics that turn up most frequently. You have the typical stories about the scourge of corruption in Ukraine. Then you have about the war in the East, in the Donbass, the war which grinds on and not much progress has been made through the Minsk process. And thirdly, the lack of reforms. You have international financial institutions and Western leaders calling for deeper reforms. So reading from a list like this, it's understandable you might get Ukraine fatigue. You have been studying and writing about Ukraine for a long time. Do you feel Ukraine fatigue?
I don't, because most of the articles that are written by Ukraine are people who are fatigued after 2 or 3 years of superficial interest in the country. The problem is that people who have followed more deeply the trends over the last 3 decades of Ukraine's development understand how dramatic the changes are and how substantial the changes have been even since the Maidan, that this is a fundamentally different country than it was in the years of Yanukovych. To be sure, corruption is very widespread, and more importantly, I would say, perpetrators of corruption are usually not punished, but the scope of corruption has been substantially narrowed. The degree of cohesiveness in the creation of a Ukrainian armed forces capable of resisting Russia means that the Ukrainian relationship to the Russian aggression is very different than it was 4 years ago or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And on reforms, Ukraine has moved very substantially forward, especially in terms of getting rid of zombie banks, maintaining a stable currency, changing the multiple pricing mechanisms that allowed for corruption in the gas sector, eliminating through Prozoro hundreds of millions of dollars of insider, dodgy, special interest contracts. All of those things taken together show how substantially Ukraine has changed in those areas. But the most substantial way Ukraine has changed is its reconfiguration of its economy, moving away from a heavily Russia-dependent, both on energy and on trade, to an EU-integrated and outwardly looking orientation. If you look where Ukrainian companies, where Ukrainian agriculture, where Ukrainian high tech is selling its services and its goods, where Ukrainian steel is exported, the whole gamut of products that Ukraine exports, it's dramatic. You know, it's a revolutionary increase. But people who have come and started covering it, typically from Moscow, are surrounded by a certain pattern. And I think that's one of the weaknesses of coverage, is that much of it is these guys who parachute in, who maybe spent a year or two covering the war in the front, and then they parachute in episodically to cover an important visit, an important event, but they don't have a real sense of how the country is changing, because it requires, I think, a heavy dose of investigation to look beyond these very facile and easy surface stories. I mean, simple stories are wonderful to tell, and there are a lot of simple stories. Yes, you can tell. I could easily write a story about in, you know, widespread corruption. I could easily write a story about lack of progress on the front. I could easily write a story about going slow on reforms, but I could as easily write the opposite story. And Ukraine is really requires a deeper understanding of where the country has been and where it's headed and what is irreversible. That said, I think that one of the consequences of this type of reporting, and to an extent, the Western tactic of pressuring for change by constantly criticizing, is that no liberal alternative has emerged, and instead you have the most progressive choice at this point in the elections is the existing president, who will continue a slow pace of reform. There is no liberal fast-track alternative that has a lot of support, and you have a populist alternative or someone who is linked to a dodgy oligarch with complicated practices who has no experience in government. So, you know, the result of this type of story that you've described is a Ukraine that would be pulled back rather than pulled forward. Mm-hmm.
So you did mention the elections that are coming up, and that's one topic that is interesting for us today. So the elections are due to be on the 31st of March, and at this point, it's about 5 weeks to go. And candidate registration is now closed, and we have currently about 44 candidates who are registered. And out of all those, only about three have a realistic chance of winning. To the outside observer, this seems a bit puzzling. You know, why so many and that don't stand really a chance of winning the election? What is your take on this? Why do we see so many candidates?
Well, first of all, there's vanity. People who have $100,000, which if you are relatively prosperous in Ukraine, is not a huge obstacle to put yourself on the ballot. Secondly, you have a lot of what would be called technical candidates whose job is to divide up the vote to prevent other candidates from getting in and to muddy the works. And the third is, the personalistic pattern of Ukrainian political parties. If you think about Ukrainian political parties, they tend to be associated with a single leader. They tend, because of the sequencing of Ukrainian elections, first you have presidential elections, then you have parliamentary elections. The candidates for president are a way of publicizing the political party for the parliamentary election. So a lot of people are running who don't have a real chance of getting elected or even getting into the second round, but who are doing it to raise the profile of their party or to raise their bargaining in creating a coalition with other political parties to say, see, I have 3%, you have 5%, I want, you know, three-eighths of all the seats in a common list. So I think those are all among the reasons. Obviously, if there was a much higher threshold of an entry cost that would be lost if you don't receive a certain proportion of votes, that would reduce the sort of frivolous candidates. So I think it's a combination of these three factors. But it's very interesting that, you know, if you looked at polls a few months ago, you probably had six or seven candidates within striking distance of making it into the second round. And everybody was, you know, nobody was more at 10 or 11%. And now people are kind of trying to figure it out. And it's really breaking down into three choices, two of which are opposition oriented and promise a radical change from the direction of the country. One promises, Yulia Tymoshenko is promising a radical change by moving to a more socially left of center policy, challenging the IMF increases on tariffs, promising larger social benefits to the population, promising some way of helping industry to finance itself, etc., etc. Another is a complete outsider, Vladimir Zelensky, whom I call Vladimir because he is Russophone, and I think he calls himself Vladimir, not Volodymyr. He, I think, represents, we don't know what, but he represents most people identify with him as a clever, sharp critic of the existing political reality. But he's not only a sharp critic of the existing political reality. He is a sharp creator of an alternate reality, because in his TV program, Sluhan Narodu, there is one thing that's missing. There's a president who's fighting corruption. There's a president who's fighting for reforms. There's a president who wants to do things in a new way. But there is no war. There are no victims of war. There are no people in hospitals. There is no blood that is being poured. And he started this program in 2015 when the war was very intensive. Now it's at a lower intensity. And he decided to create a fictional Ukraine in which a fictional president operates. Now Ukrainians are warm to a fictional president, but they should not now adjust whether this fictional president is capable of dealing with the real Ukraine. So the challenge he will have is not just bringing the dissatisfaction, but proving to the people that he is capable of dealing with a country which is partly occupied, which is under constant Russian attack, including internal subversion, and whether he has the ability to meet that challenge. And the third is a president who has been going slow on reforms, who is reluctant to use the instruments of the state to punish for past acts of corruption, but who has moved the country forward towards Western Europe, solidified the army, made remarkable changes in the culture through supporting the autocephaly of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church as a national church, and has, you know, stabilized the economy to the point where it's growing, not enough to satisfy people, but at least it's not heading in the wrong direction. So the result of all this is that the Ukrainians are coalescing around the unknown, the I would say, the pleasant to hear, which is the social, left-leaning giveaway promises of Yulia Tymoshenko, and a, you know, very slow, reluctant movement towards reform. That's hardly the hope of all the efforts that the West has invested in pushing reforms. But in the end, this is where Ukrainians are, and I think it becomes pretty clear that the election will be between a slow, steady, and maybe not particularly inspiring movement towards reform, and promises, and even more promises.
Mm. So you've observed many presidential elections in your time. And how do you find, how is this presidential election campaign different to previous ones that you have observed? Have you observed how candidates are trying to break through the cumulative skepticism of the Ukrainian electorate?
Well, I think this election is different in a different way. It's different because it's the first one that's not on an axis of choice between moving. Well, it's more like the last election. The last election was it's the second election in which moving towards Russia is not on the order of the day. But what is similar to the previous election is that none of the candidates really represent a very consistent ideological position. You really are hard pressed to say, which direction they will move the country. Yulia Tymoshenko is promising to move the country to the left, but when she governed, she sometimes worked with the IMF and sometimes broke with the IMF. Zelensky, we don't know which way he will go, and President Poroshenko is, by his party affiliation, represents a kind of a moderately social liberal direction. But because of the pressures of the IMF and of the stringencies, he's moved the country in a much more, I would say, harsh economic direction, where you've had to observe very strict budget balancing, strict efforts to try to, collect taxes and not to provide too much for the social basket, simply because the IMF and the stringencies of Western aid will not allow for it. So what I would say is that this is the last election was a debate about which person was better suited to realize the demands of the Maidan. This election is sort of on the idea of which person is best suited. It's between staying the course and continuing at a slow pace of reform, or something unknown, or something which reverses reforms with a completely new approach that has a heavy, I would say, social orientation, which some people believe will destroy cooperation with the IMF and with Western financial institutions. So I think this election is also more, in a sense, more important because you have an experienced president who most people are not very happy with. You have an inexperienced candidate with whom people are happy with, but no one knows how he would cope with Putin. And then you have a known quantity, and you're not quite sure what she's known, but she's also known for being unpredictable. And 10 years ago, she was arguing for NATO as a bulwark of Ukraine's interests. A year later, she was negotiating with Putin and hedging on NATO. So again, you're dealing with, I would say, a much more pivotal election, because I think the fate of the country will be, enough things have moved in terms of Ukrainianization, in terms of the sort of cultural national identity direction of Ukraine, that Ukrainian voters are going to be voting in an environment where they don't know what the new leaders. There are two options against the established order, and they don't know what the people who will potentially they will vote for will do once they take office. So that's the most interesting thing, that they had an idea what Poroshenko was all about. They had an idea what Tymoshenko was all about. They had an idea what Yatsenyuk was all about in the last election. They had an idea what the opposition was about. Today, there's more uncertainty about what the choices are. The only certainty is if you vote for Poroshenko, you'll get a slow, incremental, and not entirely satisfying movement towards Europe.
So if one were to look into your crystal ball, so this is what you'd say would be the likely outcome of the first round of elections.
Well, I think the likely outcome is that there will be one system-backing candidate, meaning the establishment choice and the anti-establishment choice. The question is whether that anti-establishment choice will be Yulia Tymoshenko or Vladimir Zelensky. My view is that the polls seem to indicate at the moment that Zelensky has more oomph than Tymoshenko. I think it's highly unlikely that the choice would be between two opposition candidates, because I think people who are against what is happening will eventually focus on one or the other candidate. So I think the higher odds are that it will be Poroshenko versus Zelensky, but it could also be Poroshenko versus Tymoshenko. I think the lowest odds are that it would be Tymoshenko versus Zelensky. And again, I would say, in my view, that if there is an election, Poroshenko has a better chance of beating Zelensky. Tymoshenko has a slightly better chance of beating Poroshenko if they were in the last round. And I think in the end, Tymoshenko would defeat Zelensky. So I think Zelensky is the weakest candidate, because it's a war country and people will want someone who knows the outside world, who can articulate. At some point, people are going to go into the ballot box and have to ask themselves, is the person that they've elected capable of doing what a president is responsible for, which is protecting their security, negotiating with the world, and protecting the country from outside and inside aggression?
And also in these elections, the OSCE is also running a monitoring mission, and member These upcoming elections, the OSCE is also running a monitoring mission, and member In these upcoming elections, the OSCE is also running a monitoring mission, and member countries have been invited to send observers. So what is this about, and why is this so important?
Well, you know, the OSCE is kind of the good seal of approval. Naturally, you know, the United States sends its own delegations, Canada is sending its own delegations, all of these are important. But the OSCE has traditionally been an observer that the outside world listens to make a decision of whether the process has been relatively free and fair and competitive, and whether, you know, the elections reflect the will of the people. It's established a reasonably good track record for that. And because it's multinational, it doesn't seem to reflect just the particular national foreign policy interests of a single country. Mm-hmm. So I think the OSCE is the most, I would say, credible of the mechanisms in the rest of the world for watching elections. Mm.
So, but nonetheless, this mission did become controversial, and the issue came to a head at the beginning of February when Ukraine refused to allow Russian observers to come in and monitor. So this domestically, this could have been a good position to take, but it was met, you know, with a lot of criticism from the OSCE. They used diplomatic language like deeply regret this. So rather strong critique. And how does Ukraine's justification for its position play out in places like Washington?
Well,
What was the response to this at the conference in Munich?
In terms of the United States response, the United States has not made a big issue of this. I think initially Kurt Volker indicated that he was siding with the OSCE, dismay that Russia is not there. But I think he pulled back from that position. And I don't know that the State Department has commented on this issue in any greater depth than Kurt Volker has. And I think that, you know, the rationale of Ukraine is reasonable. The country's on a war footing. It's occupied by a country that would be observing its own internal processes. And I think that it's important whatever Ukraine does in the end, and I think they will stick to their guns. I hope they stick to their guns. Even if they don't, I think they've made the point that Russia and that the war is a Russian-prosecuted aggression. Because if Ukraine did not take this step, it would be contributing to covering up the reality. The reality is that there is a Russian occupation, that the leadership of the DNR and LNR are directed by Russian security structures and Russian intelligence structures and financed economically by Russia, that this is not a civil war. And I think Ukraine has to make that point constantly, because Europe prefers to be able to have a more open relationship with Russia, to make it seem as if it's an internal Ukrainian problem, when it is a problem of global importance, of Russian aggression and changing the borders and invading a neighboring state. I think Ukraine will continue to hear messages. I don't think they're going to be particularly strong. But you have to also think that the OSCE has no real mechanism for enforcement. If they did, where is their mechanism of enforcement of Russia's territorial violation of Ukraine? Russia remains inside the OSCE. It is rewarded by the right to monitor Ukrainian elections in a country that it has occupied. And that's unbelievable. I don't think that the United States during the Iraq war would have allowed Saddam Hussein to send a delegation to monitor the Ukrainian elections, the U.S. elections. And I don't think they would have allowed the government of then North Vietnam to monitor the elections when the U.S. was in a war, an undeclared war, but nevertheless a war with the People's Republic of Vietnam.
And one last question. Last week, we saw another episode in the on again, off again saga of Minister Ulana Suprun. And the story was that acting Minister Ulana Suprun was banned from fulfilling her duties as acting Minister of Health by the District Administrative Court of Kyiv. And there, because there was a request filed by Ihor Mosichuk, an MP from the Radical Party. So there was a large protest from many people, many ordinary people, and a significant number of medical experts defended Suprun, as well as the president, the prime minister, even the justice minister came to speak to the judge in question. And then about a week later, the judge did, in fact, reverse this decision. So what does this news story tell us about the state of health reform in Ukraine? And what does it tell you about judicial reform?
Well, I think what it tells you is that there is a powerful group of economic interests, especially in the pharmacological, pharmaceutical field, that have a lot of power and influence a lot of deputies in many political factions. That's one reason why it's not possible to push through the, you know, parliament to vote for Ms. Suprun. There's not a majority for her support, because in every faction there is this money that is influencing the behavior of legislators in the Rada. I think there is no question that what is called by some the pharma mafia is really behind all of this. So it's, she created, this is not about even her reforms of creating a system where there's a more direct relationship between a primary care physician and services provided and remuneration to doctors. That over time, I think, will become popular. But the real opposition is not, there may be some individual physicians that are involved that have accumulated minor fortunes, but the real money is in the pharmacological, pharmaceutical side. And I think that is what we're seeing at play. Mm-hmm. That is what is, I'm going to say it, corrupted the political process. That is what is behind these torts, these lawsuits to remove her from office. Ulana Suprun, if anything, by the kind of enemies that she has acquired, and we will remember Mr. Mosichuk was famous for being taped receiving a cash emolument for his support of a certain position. So we know he is capable of corruption, because we've seen it in a video where he was bribed by another official and money was changed over the table and recorded in video for all of us to see. So we know that he and Mr. Lashko's party are reflective of that kind of influence on their political decisions. I think what that proves is that Ulana Suprun is a person of great integrity, that, you know, she is trying to move the country forward. She's trying to implement deep reforms. And she has touched upon and reformed a very important part of the economy, which means that more drugs are getting to people at lower prices, and those people are going to be safer and healthier. And she's contributed something. She's actually accomplished something. And that's the reason why we go back to your original question, that no, reforms have not stalled. Serious reforms have occurred in many places. Ulana Suprun is just one of those places. Ukrainians have to understand that and embrace it, and embrace their heroes.
Thank you. And on that note, I'm afraid we'll have to wrap it up. Our time is up. Thank you very much, Adrian Karatnitsky, for coming in to talk to us here in the studio.
And now moving on to music. Pleve Kacha Potesinyu became Ukraine's unofficial song of mourning in February 2014, when dozens of protesters were massacred in the final standoff during the Revolution of Dignity, just around and before the Maidan. So the protesters won but paid a high price, and this song was played at the funeral and then has become a very popular tune, which is associated with the sufferings and deaths that Ukrainians have encountered as a result of Russian aggression that has followed the events on the Maidan. This week, as you've already heard, Ukraine commemorated the killings of those who were subsequently called the Heavenly Hundred, the martyrs of the Maidan, and the song was played all over the country. In fact, it was written way back in 1944 when Ukraine was embroiled in World War II. And popular musician Taras Chubai recorded it in the late 1990s. But as he said in a recent BBC interview, back then it was not that popular because there were no casualties nearby and there was no war raging. Enjoy.
Лежа потисені, ой, пливе кача потисені. Мамко моя, не лай мені. Мамко моя, не лай мені. Залаєш ми погину, сам не знаю, де погину.
And looking forward. Well, next week we will be following the main stories in Ukraine again. Tune in for a new episode of Ukraine Calling for Hromadske Radio here in Kyiv. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. Write to us at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Bohdan Nahailo for Hromadske Radio in Kyiv. Thanks so much for listening.